From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Wednesday when Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren announced a curfew in an effort to curb recent violence in Rochester. Warren's emergency order bans public gatherings of five or more people and private gatherings of 10 or more unrelated people between the hours of 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. Earlier on Wednesday, city officials reported that 20 people had been shot or stabbed over the past 2 weeks. Warren added that many of those incidents were preceded by large parties, and now with the emergency order, anyone who breaks the curfew could be charged with a misdemeanor. But that didn't stop protesters from taking the streets Wednesday night and Thursday morning. Organizers with Free the People Rock called the curfew anti-black and discriminatory and say that it was a way to, quote, further criminalize black and brown people instead of addressing the root causes of crime, end quote. But other local leaders who have spent years addressing anti-violence efforts in the city say they have supported this new curfew and view it as a way to address the rising number of violent incidents this summer. This hour, our guests debate the curfew and discuss their ideas for how to address violence in Rochester. Let's welcome our guests now. Iman Abid is the co-leader of Free the People Rock. She's back on the line with us. So, Iman, welcome back to the program.
Hey, good to see you, Evan. Actually, I'm here on a New York Civil Liberties Union today. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I want to make sure. So go ahead and give the listeners then your full official title under what you're representing today. Go ahead.
I'm the chapter director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the ACLU of New York. Thanks.
Thank you for that. Also with us is Reverend Lewis Stewart, the president of United Christian Leadership Ministry. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon. Pleased to be here. Hi, everyone.
And hello. And Carrie Coleman is the chair of Community Police Relations of UCLM. Carrie, welcome back to the program as well.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
And we do expect to have Stanley Martin momentarily. We have not been able to get a hold of Stanley, who is a co-leader of Free the People Rock, but we're working on that. We will add a fourth guest in just a moment here. Let me start with this, though, because, Iman, you helped, and I know there's a number of people who led some of the organization Wednesday into Thursday against this new curfew. Take me through your objection to it.
So I think the focus here is the fact that it's based on the document itself. The emergency order as it stands is strictly expressing its issues with the public health crisis. But yet the mayor's press conference just last week was focused primarily on reducing gun violence. And so there was a little bit of a discrepancy around what the intention of the emergency order itself was. And so, of course, after kind of reading more of the language in the emergency order and just trying to see how historically we've seen curfews unable to actually curtail gun violence or any other forms of crimes, you know, it kind of became a concern to us. And of course, at the end of the day, most curfews themselves, as kind of just seen on the surface, just usually violate the First Amendment rights. And so here, as we see people protesting and assembling, we want to make sure that we give them the freedoms to do that. But we also understand that, you know, the circumstances, and so I think that's kind of like the concern that we had with the emergency order itself.
So I understand the concern on the legal side of things. Do you agree with the criticism that there is a racial component here?
Yes, I do think that with the exceptions in the cutout itself that's made to the restaurants and bars, which we know are generally, of course, in more predominantly white neighborhoods. And where often we see in predominantly black neighborhoods where people may gather out on the streets and kind of hang out, we see that. And the fact is the press conference itself, you know, that was hosted by the mayor, Councilman Lightfoot, and Lauren Singletary, there was a mention to saying that the order itself was going to be enforced in hot spots. And very often those hot spots are associated with high crime areas. And those high crime areas are very often associated with predominantly black neighborhoods. And it's this incredibly racist narrative that's been used to enforce a curfew that historically, again, has not actually ever been able to prove that it would reduce gun violence. And then with the exception being made to the bars and restaurants, which are in predominantly white neighborhoods, you know, for instance, like along the East End, we don't necessarily use, well, for instance, law enforcement doesn't very often use hotspots as a way to describe those areas. And so there's this racially discriminatory kind of narrative that very often is used around curfews and wanting to implement them. And I kind of see that happening here as well.
Reverend Lewis Stewart, how do you see this curfew order?
Well, I Iman is a good friend of mine and very dear to me, but I disagree with her that it is a racial component. I believe it's race that matters in the sense that most of the violence that's emanating from out of the neighborhoods are impacting young black people, and the perpetrators are young black people. Let me compare it with this. Governor Cuomo, during the height of this COVID-19, which is still going on, prohibited religious communities from having public worship. And for me, that was a violent violation of First Amendment rights, the right to assemble, the right to corporate worship, but yet it was done anyway. Let me say this. From my perspective, a gun violence is a public health crisis. And anything that we can do in order to curtail gun violence is necessary. We looked the other day, just this past weekend, there was a big fight out in Henrietta. I think about 50 to 60 young people were involved in that. Let me say something else. Since 1980, we have had 300,000 black people die of gun violence. So it is a public health crisis. We also know that the curfew is a temporary stopgap measure because gun violence is much more complicated than that. And so I agree with the curfew that it had to be done in order to stop aggregate numbers of youth from meeting. In fact, I had a nephew, my brother-in-law's son, who was killed at a party maybe two couple years back because of this. At the Boys and Girls Club, we had three or four people, young people, that were killed. So something has got to be done to deal with it, and we are not really addressing the full impact of this issue. But it's there, and that's why I agree temporarily with the curfew.
Let me bring in Stanley Martin, who's a co-leader of Free the People Rock, who's with us now. Stanley, you've just heard what Reverend Lewis Stewart had to say about it. What do you think about this curfew?
So I want to start by saying Reverend Stewart is an elder in our community, someone I definitely respect. And though we may have differing opinions, I still want to, you know, hold space for respecting all the work he's done for our community. So thank you for being on the line, and thanks for all you've done. In regards to the curfew, I do think that it's very racialized, and it criminalizes black and brown people. As we know, there are white people congregating in bars across the city around the same time that black and brown people are being policed for gathering. I think it's also very anti-poor, because you have to have a certain amount of money to be able to spend at a bar or go out to eat to meet with your family. So it's very problematic. I strongly disagree with it.
Kerry Coleman, your thoughts on the curfew?
Wow, where can I start? I want to say hi to Iman, because she's a good friend of mine, too, also. It's kind of a slippery slope, okay? I feel that a lot of trauma in the black community is not being addressed. I feel that you have to have drastic measures for drastic times. And it's a lot of black and brown people dying in our communities. And sometimes we have to step across the line to do things to make things happen. Now, I agree with Iman about how it's disproportionately, put out here. But a lot of the murders, a lot of the stabbings, a lot of the loss of life in our communities must be looked at. And if we don't look at it from an aspect of a mental health aspect, a trauma aspect, and how our neighborhood's been deprived for over many years, many generations, then this is going to be a continuing argument for my kids and my grandkids. We need to look at the root of the problem. We need to look at the measures of how we go about it. And I agree with my brother, Lewis Stewart. This is unacceptable.
So, Iman, you've heard some of the concern from the other guests who obviously, you've worked with and you know and respect you. So let's start with what you've heard from Reverend Stewart and from Kerry Coleman about why they think that maybe there's a difference of opinion with you there, Iman.
Yeah, I mean, I would never sit here trying to condemn any opinion, especially by three incredible black civil rights leaders in our region. And I have so much respect for Reverend Stewart, Kerry, and Stanley, of course. So I'm not here to condemn any of those opinions. I mean, we can each have our own opinion around what we feel curfews are actually intended to do. I think I'm looking at it from more of the historical perspective, whereas sometimes we're looking at it from more of the, practical perspective. Like, what is this actually, you know, based on the way that it was addressed by the mayor, and how it's curfews are very often used as an apparent means to protect. But what I'm referencing is that, historically, they've actually never shown proof to protect. Again, that's by no means to sit here and condemn any of the things that were shared, but rather, again, just thinking back. I mean, we're talking about decades worth of curfews. Curfews were used to literally enforce housing segregation. I mean, we had the whole concept of like sundown towns, right? Like where Black people were not permitted from entering certain towns after sunset. I mean, we're talking about, the same sorts of curfews that were used in the Rochester race riots of 1964, the riots of Rodney King in 1992. You know, there's so many sorts of moments in our civil rights history where we've seen curfews pop up, and very often they've been used to silence protesters. Very often they've been used to actually silence Black people specifically. And when we're talking about right now in this moment of like the Black Lives Matter movement all across the country, we're also talking about a state where people are very agitated by the police. So to actually then use a curfew that then also increases police presence on the streets doesn't necessarily actually do anything but form tension, and it's counterproductive to the movement. All it does is it continues to silence people. I can't necessarily speak to what it's like and what the experience of a Black person in the city is like, because I'm not Black. So I won't sit here explaining that at that as well. But I think it's just very important to recognize, just based again, like throughout history, how have we seen these curfews kind of playing themselves out? And in this moment, I mean, again, the curfew was enacted at a time where it was planned. I mean, it was not necessarily a surprise. Curfews had been popping up back and forth here in New York City, other cities. So it was just another tactic that was going to be used by a municipality to try to curtail the movement in some way.
So, Reverend Stewart, what about Iman's point there that this is a moment where there is more tension between, to speak monolithically about a Black community or communities of color and police, and that this kind of an order, number one, hasn't worked historically, number two, has been used in racist ways in the past, and number three, is only going to bring more contact between police and communities of color?
Well, I respect Iman's opinion, as always, and Stanley's too, as well, and also Brother Carey's. But let me say this. Iman just took on a historical experience dealing with segregation, et cetera, in which he was right to raise. But this phenomena of gun violence has raised its head since basically the 1980s, especially all across the country. And because that was fueled by a lot of other things, drugs and some other stuff. So the whole issue of the fact that it might exacerbate conflicts between police and community, yes, I totally agree with that, because I certainly am in the forefront, UCLM is, in terms of police reform. But the whole issue is, I think we've got to look at it not in terms of the criminalization of Black people and young Black men and women, but it's about saving lives. And here's the thing. I've had four people in my family. I've had my brother-in-law's son was shot to death. My own brother's nephew was shot to death. I had cousins who were shot to death by people or perpetrators with illegal weapons. So although a curfew is not a end-all or panacea to end violence, but yet we look at it as a temporary a stopgap measure. And not only that, but if you would dare take a poll of most older Black people in the Black community, you will ascertain and discover that most older Black people in the community, I would say from 40s, 30s on up, agree with the curfew. Because if you go into the Black community and you hear all these gunshots and the shootings and things of that sort, it's like living in another country where violence is just pervasive. People are sick and tired of it. People want to prevent this type of thing from happening. And if we can put a temporary curfew in it in which people's lives are saved, then so be it. So be it. Because we must be about saving lives. It's not about criminalization. It's about saving Black lives.
Well, and so Stanley Martin, can you respond to that? The Reverend is saying that in his estimation, most older black people, starting in the 40s, which I find offensive that that's older, but that's, listen, 40s and up. 40s and up.
Yeah, I'm up there too.
Stanley, the Reverend thinks, though, that, you know, that his honest belief is that you would find a majority support among black residents here 40 and up. What would you say to that, Stanley? Do we have Stanley?
Just coming from?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Stanley.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
So I understand where the Reverend is coming from. And I think a lot of, you know, the concern is so genuine and so real. And we're all desperately trying to find a solution to violence. However, like you said, a curfew is not the end all be all. And it's, in fact, you know, furthermore, ineffective in addressing the root causes of violence and harm. I think the older adults, you know, 40 and up, which is shocking to me, you know, it's now 40, might say that the, although Reverend Stewart thinks they might agree with the curfew, I think more so what they will agree with is the need to find a solution to violence and supporting, you know, things that might seem like a good idea on its face, but in reality it's not. I think we know how we address violence in communities that don't have high statistics regarding violence are communities that have access to resources, have access to safe, secure housing, have limited police presence in their communities. So we see those as the safest communities. So I think the lockdown is a knee-jerk reaction. It kind of lacks depth in understanding the complexity of crime, especially as it relates to the black community, who's historically been depleted of resources and opportunities for economic growth. So I think we need to, instead of the curfew, focus on providing resources to these communities.
Yeah, I think Stanley's making a point that we're going to explore in our second half hour. If not the curfew, then what? And we will talk about that, that Stanley is...
Sure.
But Kerry Coleman, let me follow up with you then, because Stanley's point is, even if Reverend Stewart is correct, that a majority of black people over the age of 40 would support this, she's saying that's because on the face of it, it sounds like it might work and people do want solutions. People don't want violence. But historically, this doesn't work. We're supporting something that has had issues, sort of racist roots in the past. And at the very least, this iteration is not likely to work. Kerry, do you think this will work?
I think yes and no. And this is why. I think we talk about the root causes that's affecting our communities, especially the black communities. And like my brother Stewart said, you know, during the 80s, a lot of things were going on in our communities to rip apart families. Okay, a lot of the trauma, the incarceration, different things that was affected different generations coming up that made us who we are as men, were taking away out of the family. You have basically grandmothers and aunts raising young men sometimes. You don't have a father figure in the household. Not to be chauvinistic and say a woman can't do the same job, but there's some other internal things that's going on in our families that's affecting our communities. And I think that is being overlooked. Our education system that's involved, that's being overlooked. See, these things, we can throw curfews out here left and right, okay? I agree. But for right now, this is needed. Because what's happening in our communities is a lash out of behaviors against other individuals, okay? We can't lash out against others, but we can lash out against each other. And that's the trauma right there that needs to be addressed. Why is this happening like this? And no one's really looking at that factor.
Well, listeners, if you want to weigh in on this program as we talk about the curfew that Mayor Warren says is designed to prevent violence and keep communities safe, especially this summer, that curfew involving five or more people in public gatherings after 11 p.m. and before 5 a.m., 10 or more unrelated people between those hours. Listeners, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Alex White is on the line with the first phone call. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, do people remember when Rochester had a curfew about 15 years ago when it ended up going to court and the courts ruled very clearly that in order for a curfew to be considered legal, it has to include provisions for First Amendment rights to assembly, speech, and religion. Now, this doesn't seem to have that. But my real question is, In view of the possible illegality of this, is there no other thing we can do that might be more legal?
Right.
It might deal with the violence problem? Is this the only tool in our toolbox is to do something strictly illegal?
And that's why I said it was a problem.
And that's a good question, if I might interject, because 100 people a day die of gun violence nationally. 100 people a day. 300,000 people have died since 1980. I'm talking about black people now. And, and 85,000 a year die from gun injuries. So the question, and gun violence is a public health issue. In fact, the American Medical Association has tried to get gun violence as a public health issue, but we know a Republican-controlled Congress, et cetera, has rejected because they care very little for black lives anyway. But the problem is the solution is so complicated and complex.
Yes.
And
yes.
Evan wants to get into the solutions in the second half of the show. So I will wait.
You can go right now because that's where we are here. I mean, essentially, Reverend, that's what Iman and Stanley are saying, that they're agreeing with Alex, that history has indicated it's probably not legal. It's not effective. And, you know, as Stanley mentioned, resource redeployment is how they see a starting step toward. Where do you, I know, Kerry, it sounds like you want to jump in. Go ahead, Kerry.
Yeah, so I agree with that part. The resource allocation is very key and important because we have to address the issues. We can't just, you know, put a Band-Aid on it. But I agree with this Band-Aid to an extent. And the legality of what Alex is saying is correct also. But like I said before in my opening statement, drastic measures for drastic times. We got people dying out here. Just like we put in different type of issues with the coronavirus quarantine. We have to do things to be proactive. Now, how we go about being proactive has to be looked at, okay? How the community must be talked to in a way where it's, what are the solutions? And I think that the city did not do that. Go to the community first and said, hey, what do we need? We're with you. And see, when the community sees, when you do things like this, just put it out there, then there's going to be a offset in a way, whereas the community, like Iman and Stanley is saying, this is a historic type of issue we do not like. And I think if they'd have reached out to the community and say, hey, what do we need to do? Then this would have been a little bit more easy. Also, too, the reallocation of the funds. Right, we need to address the mental health issues. We need to look at taking the guns off these streets because none of us, as black and brown, have airplanes bringing these guns in. And we need to look at that issue of how these guns are getting into our community because none of us are going down to Virginia or Texas bringing these guns in. And I think there's another underlying issue with that and how these guns are being trickled into our neighborhood because they're not going into the white communities like this. They're going in our community. These little cheap guns, big guns.
Right.
Can
I say? Okay. Can I intervene? Can I say this?
Yes, sir.
Can I say this? And I agree totally with what everybody is saying because it's a temporary measure. But we've got some problems in the community. And Kerry, you're right. Stanley is right. Iman is right. Alex is right. I think everybody is right because because the issue is one of death and it's so complicated. First of all, we have never really addressed the issue of entrenched poverty. Our Matthew was supposed to do that, but never really addressed it. And poverty is entrenched in Rochester more than ever before. We need to look at economic development. How do we create and develop more black businesses? But yet there are systemic barriers to the creation of more black businesses. Our educational system here in Rochester is broken. We need jobs with a career trajectory and mobility. There's inadequate affordable housing, which needs to be made available. We need to make affordable housing more available, not only in the city, but also in the suburbs. And we need more black business, and Kerry is right. We need to look at these guns. Just as drugs were brought in here in the 80s, so guns are being brought in here. Now, these guns, straw purchases, illegal weapons being stolen or people selling weapons out of the back of their of their vehicles, et cetera.
Yes.
That
yes.
is a big problem. So the mayor's situation relative to the curfew is only a temporary measure. These are other problems that must be addressed. And we're not going to address it by a lot of marches and a lot of protests. We have to look at analyzing this. We have to bring people to the table. We have to negotiate with people. And we have to say to them, we're not going to take any more of this because this is a public health crisis. And mm-hmm. government,
definitely.
Economic institutions, the business sector, as well as the police are responsible for it.
Stanley Martin, I'll start with you. You're the first who brought up on this panel the reallocation of resources. You've heard some of what Kerry Coleman and Reverend Stewart have had to say about that. Agree or disagree with what you've heard so far?
I agree with a lot of what I've heard so far, especially as it comes to the reallocation of resources. But one thing I do want to talk about is, you know, when it comes to the curfew and reallocating these resources, when we have people out on the street and they're arrested for protesting or being out past the curfew, we're now criminalizing them and getting them involved in the criminal legal system. This now means that it can impact their ability to access jobs. It can impact their ability to access affordable housing. So then it's really, really one step in the process of, you know, putting Black people in a pipeline to jails and prisons and limiting their ability to thrive. Because we know once you're in the system, it's extremely difficult to break out of it. So it doesn't sound like the goals we're trying to accomplish regarding economic development and having Black people thrive, not just survive, can be met with this curfew. It seems, you know, actually counterproductive to the goals that we speak about, like all of us here are talking about. So I challenge us to look a bit deeper when we think about the curfew. And it being a temporary solution even points out to how problematic it is. We don't need temporary solutions for deep entrenched problems such as poverty. We need strategic solutions. We need all hands on deck. And I think protesting is one piece of it, but we also need people like Reverend Stewart at the table, people like Kerry Coleman at the table, really talking about what the next steps are. So I think it's all in a continuum. All actions people take are important, but we also have to have a deeper, complex understanding of it.
Well, and Iman, as we've talked about in, you know, really since the killing of George Floyd, the question of what happens next in many communities across the country centers on what are often finite resources. And I understand there's a lot of reallocation that can happen. There's different sources of funding that could happen. But if we're going to be direct about it, you got to make decisions about how much money goes to police, how much money goes to other parts of the community. Do you think this community is being direct enough with that conversation, Iman?
So we really depend on who we're talking about in the community. But I want to address one thing, too, is that, you know, Alex's question poses this idea around the illegality of the curfew itself. And one thing that I also want to pose us to question is whether or not we have to use these curfews as a way to set norms for what society actually has to endure. I think that we very often just expect because something comes out of the law or something comes out of, you know, the mayor's office or the city council's office, is that it must be just to some extent. And what I'm trying to also explain here is that we must put these things to question. So the curfew itself was just a catalyst to everything else that's been put into place, right? The amount of power, the authority that's been given to policing over time, not just here in RPD, but all across the country since the existence of police. Why, you know, we are in a state now that, and the George Floyd incident kind of like served as this catalyst for what movement we've now seen this past summer, so that we can start putting into question this entire institution. Again, this is not the first time that people have brought this up. There have been so many Black civil rights leaders along the way. And Reverend Sewer, you are one of them. You've done so much work around this. And there are so many others who aren't in this table today who have discussed just how important it is to put this into question, to question why, for instance, policing kind of has itself and, you know, its hands are kind of tied up in everything. It's social services, mental health services, education. Why have we given so much power to police to do such? We have no other institution that's tied up in other agencies the way that the police are. And we know that the police, and Reverend Stewart, you know, we've worked together for so long, and we've sat down across the table with these police officers. We continue to. And we sit and we see the mentality and the culture and just how much power these people think that they actually have. So now we're doing what we're doing is by challenging the curfew and whether it's whether or not it's constitutionally the only thing that's being challenged, the curfew itself is also criminalizing Black and brown people who are living in poverty. And very often any sort of like incarceral tool, any sort of like state sanctioned tool is very often used to in incarcerate and to criminalize those living already in poverty, which still very much is Black and brown people, as we talk about in the city of Rochester. And whether it's RMAPI or if it's the new structural racism equity commission that's come out of the city, you know, I'm not really actually hopeful that any of those things are actually going to take on those systemic issues. And so here we are again, sitting down, putting these things to question so that people can start thinking of a future that we've never been able to envision before, because we got to think beyond the norms that have been set for communities of color. We have to think beyond the norms that the law has kind of set for us, because the law itself needs to be put to question, not here just in the curfew alone, but all other forms of sanctioned violence that have been permitted, again, through various jurisdictions, various court systems. So I think right now we're kind of just in this state where everything needs to be put into question. We need to rethink what we actually can envision and how things can actually benefit communities of color. And again, the narrative that we use to implement and enforce curfews like this are very often false. Again, so we're sitting here talking about how these curfews are meant to protect, but in reality, again, they've never protected. But I also understand that we must address these issues of gun violence. But do we have to do it through a curfew? Do we have to do it through a way that curtails and silences Black and brown people? Absolutely not. There are so many ways to address the systemic issues, figuring out how we can invest in the neighborhoods, figuring out how we can actually uplift those voices in other ways that isn't going to be used through the incarceral state or through policing.
Well, we have to take our only break of the hour. And when we come back, I've got two emails from listeners that I think will help frame the conversation for the rest of the way. You just heard Iman Abid, who is the director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the ACLU of New York, Stanley Martin, co-leader of Free the People Rock. Reverend Lewis Stewart is the president of UCLM, United Christian Leadership Ministry, and Kerry Coleman is the chair of Police Community Relations for United Christian Leadership Ministry. And we're going to get those comments from listeners and our guest feedback on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, the Nature Conservancy of Western and Central New York wanted to find out just how much New Yorkers want life to go back to normal, to pre-pandemic life, when there's finally a vaccine or an end to this pandemic. Turns out there's still a desire for more permanent change when it comes to access to nature, climate action, and more. They explain next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Nathan writes to say, I worry that Reverend Stewart is using the argument that the ends might justify the means with policy. Would the Reverend be okay with other circumstances like stop and frisk? I worry that both stop and frisk and the Rochester curfew don't have a positive track record and are not grounded in evidence. That's from Nathan. Reverend Stewart, go ahead.
I don't understand how you can equate a curfew with stop and frisk. I'm a Black man, so why would I ascribe to stop and frisk? What I do ascribe to is anything that's legal, that's going to stop the violence that's going on in the city of Rochester and going to bring a halt to meaninglessness and unnecessary deaths. That's what I'm for. To interject stop and frisk and some other issues into that, it makes no sense at all to me. That's it.
Okay. Well,
can I comment on that?
Yeah, please, Stanley.
I kind of hear where Nathan is coming from a little bit, not in relation to Reverend Stewart, but in relation to the system and our mayor. We have to think about the mayor endorsing Bloomberg, who is the father of stop and frisk. So
yes.
I don't think it's such a far reach to connect the dots and say this is, you know, one of those broken window policing tactics that finds an excuse to come into a community and racially profile people who are there to, you know, justify arresting them. So I kind of see that connection.
Reverend, you want to follow that then?
No, I don't see that connection at all. When Stanley brings up about the former Mayor Bloomberg, who's the father of stop and frisk or racial profiling. Yes, but I don't see any connection at all between what I said in supporting a stopgap measure and racial profiling. Again, let me repeat myself. We must do anything and everything short of exacerbating situations in the Black community to stop gun violence. Gun violence is a public health issue. It is an epidemic. I mean, look at Chicago about, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks ago, when about 500 people were shot to death or killed or wounded in one weekend. That's what we must deal with, this fratricide that's going on, this bloodshed that is taking place. Although a curfew is not going to stop it, although it is a temporary solution, but we must look to more permanent solutions that are going to deal with this particular issue. Go ahead.
Well,
I just want to interject too also about the stop and frisk. The stop and frisk was put in as almost as a law, and it affected Black and brown communities, enabling police to profile individuals. All right, this curfew is just a temporary measure to try to get a hold on the violence over the weekend. I think it's like arguing apples and oranges, and there's a big difference. And I understand what this caller is talking about, but as a Black male, I'd rather have a curfew that's maybe going to last a week than a law like stop and frisk that I feel fearful to come out of my front door and go through my community while being stopped or accosted by the police.
Iman, you want to add there, Iman, on the legal side of things? I mean, especially with Nathan sort of drawing a link to stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm. What specifically do you want me to address?
Well, I mean, do you see a link between either the legality, illegality? Do you think there is any comparison between stop and frisk and the curfew?
I think they're all measures that are used to, again, restrict and silence Black voices. I think that's historically where they all kind of, you know, their foundation is all from the same thing. Again, it's this power that we've given to policing, and the curfew itself is not just necessarily something that comes out of the mayor's office alone. It's going to be enforced by the police. Stop and frisk is enforced by the police. You know, all these, like, a lot of these tactics have been brought to question over and over again, some of them dismantled. And because of the illegality of the existence of the tactics themselves. And so, yeah, I do think that it's, essentially they all come from the same place.
Let me read.
Yeah,
Paul.
But why do we want to equate that the mayor through the curfew is trying to stop and silence the voices of protest? That's not true at all. I think we're looking at one side instead of the other side. And I've stated the obvious time and time again on this show, and so has Brother Kerry. The obvious is to draw some attention and to stop prevent any type of gun violence. It has nothing to do, as far as I'm concerned, what I've observed, with the silence of protesters' voices. I don't want my voice silenced if I was protesting. So I don't think one has anything to do with the other.
And I want to respond to that, because protesters who are out there exercising their right to protest were arrested because of the curfew. And also, you mentioned that gun violence is a public health crisis. And I agree with you fully. And so is the opioid epidemic. And what were people experiencing in opioid use disorder guests from the state and our city? They got treatment centers. They got resources. So instead of putting a curfew on people, we're asking for that same care, that same attention and understanding a complex problem should be met with resources and care and recovery centers for gun violence and the trauma it causes in our community. Not a police presence to address that. I don't think that's fair at all.
Right. I agree with you, but the initial step is we must draw attention to the solution or to the problem. And drawing attention to the problem is the curfew to stop the gatherings of people in the neighborhoods where fights usually break out and then death or shootings occur. That's the issue. And I wish we would need to look at that.
I want to address what Stanley has said. I think he had a key point there, what was said. You know, the treatment and the allocation of resources in different communities. You got to look at, we have an opioid crisis. Now we want to have different types of laws that help people to do this. But if you remember in the 80s, we had an epidemic that came through our community, and we were jailed. We were ostracized. They broke up families. They even went to the point of making laws, minimum sentencing laws, for people with drugs. So I agree. We have to look at this picture holistically, okay, because the difference on how the laws are applied is totally different in our communities, Black and brown communities, compared to white communities.
Iman, did I hear you, Iman?
Yeah, I just,
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to say something. So, again, this is actually why these issues of legality kind of came up, because the emergency order itself actually has no mention of gun violence. It's not about gun violence the language itself that's used in the emergency order has nothing to do with gun violence. It has everything to do with public health, which says to me, again, why are we, it sounds like there's still a little bit of confusion around why this was even implemented in the first place. Because in the press conference, it was mentioned that it was used to curb gun violence, but in the document itself, it was mentioned that it meant to address public health crisis, even with the fact that there were exceptions made to restaurants and bars. Again, so there's a lot of confusion around what this was for. And again, I think if we want to hold the law accountable to like what it's actually supposed to be doing, it's not even doing what you're saying, because it's saying something completely different. So I think that's exactly why it's being brought to question at the moment. But by no means, again, like, you know, I think I hear everyone out. I'm just trying to bring attention to the fact that the emergency order has no mention of gun violence.
There's
a couple of other emails I'm going to try to squeeze in. Paul says, the issue is not in black and brown communities. The issue is police abuse, and you can't have police abuse if there are no police. And then Paul writes in all caps, abolish the police.
Reverend, oh, my goodness.
Reverend Stewart, go ahead.
That is the most ridiculous statement I ever heard in my life. Most black people in the black community, they want a police presence. Yes. But they want a police presence not as occupiers, but as guardians and protectors. They want a police presence not as racist, but non-racist police who really care about the community. In America, let me give everyone a small history lesson. America has a romantic attachment to the gun, always has. To paraphrase H. Rapp Brown, and this is telling my age, Evan, America is as racist and as gun violent prone as cherry pie. That's the bottom line. And so black people in most communities, they want police protection, but they do not want the police to operate as they have been operating, with clear brutality, with clear disrespect for human life, clearly with criminalizing people and throwing people in jail. We need the police, but we need better trained police. And so let's reinvest some of those dollars into training. Here's what UCLM has been calling for. UCLM has been calling for having the community involved in the hiring of police, which we don't have right now. And so we should be involved in that. Number two, we should have more mental health practitioners on the street instead of the police to try and de-escalate situations and conflict. Number three, at the police academy level, there should be racial education and training, not diversity training, not implicit bias training, but training deal with racism and dealing with internal racism in the police departments. And those are some of the things that UCLM is calling for.
Let me get all of you, and I'll ask Stanley Martin to respond next. Go ahead, Stanley.
Yeah, so we cannot conflate the need for people asking for safety with the need for policing. Public safety does not mean police. Public safety means resources. It means having access to safe schools, having access to a strong community network where if you need something, you can call someone and they can help. So I think I strongly disagree with equating the need for safety and resources to people saying that they need the police. We can no longer afford to ask violence workers to come in and provide mental health assistance. They simply don't have the range. When someone is trained with a gun, they're not going to also be somehow able to assist with mental health crises. We're asking too much of violence workers who are the police. And instead, we need actual resources in our community to address these problems that come up.
To be clear, Stanley, before I turn to Carrie and Amon, you think that Rochester and all communities in this country can safely exist into the future without police at all, no police?
I absolutely think that, but that does not mean we don't have security. That does not mean we don't have people to address harm that happens. I think we keep trying to reform the system of policing, and Reverend Stewart has done an enormous amount of work to even have body cams turned on, but we see they don't even turn on their body cameras. Reform is not working. We just need to rebuild. we can have security, we can have mental health workers, we can have public safety that does not include the currently institutionally racist system of policing. And we see different communities do that. And I'm not saying we're not going to have people to call for help, because when people call the police, they're calling for help. So instead, we have systems that actually provide help when people are asking for help, not people coming in with guns, not people who are racist, and not people who come in to harm us.
Okay. And just to kind of to lay that out then, where does the call for help go in that scenario?
So in that scenario, there would still be a number where people call, just like you have 311, a non-emergency line. You can have that same system where someone is having, for example, a mental health crisis, or someone is having a nonviolent issue that's happening, like fireworks. You have a member from that community paid to come in and address those issues. Like when I call for help, I do not want a white man who doesn't live in my community with a gun come knocking on my door. No, I want someone who has mental health training, someone who understands the problems I'm facing and has real, real training in actually addressing those issues.
Kerry Coleman, I
Stanley, I respect your discourse. But let me tell you something. You're living in America. You're living in America with a triple K. And violence is endemic in America, and so is crime. And so you need a police force that's going to deal with issues of crime, rape, sexual child molestation, robberies, things of that sort. And black people want public safety. They really do. And public safety, whatever you want to call it, they want police, but they want a better trained, non-racist police force. And in America, due to the culture and history of this country, we do need a police force that's better trained. We do.
Stanley, you want to respond?
So this is the thing. You even just said it. We need public safety. We deserve public safety. And I'm saying public safety does not have to be the police. The police come after the fact, after the crime has been committed, been done. And since they have been around for so long, if they were effective, why would harm still continue to be happening? Why do people still have guns in Rochester? Why is violence still happening? And we have the police $100 million.
I'll tell you why. That is because the Congress refused to give monies to the Drug Enforcement Agency and to the Firearms Agency to do the investigations that were necessary to get illegal guns off the streets. That's why Mitch McConnell and his ilk refused to do so. And part of the problem that we have today is because they refused to fund those federal programs.
Mm. I hear you, but I'm saying we know them being around, them collecting $100 million has not curbed crime in the city of Rochester. So why do we continue to give money to a group that is not effective? Just simply put, they're just not effective in curbing crime, but we just still continue to pour into them. When we know people need resources, we're asking for these resources to go back into the community. Think of all the work you've done at UCLM, Reverend Stewart. If you had enough and way more resources, how much more could you have accomplished? So we're thinking of people who are from the community, who are connected. If you came knocking on my door, Reverend Stewart, and told me this thing needs to change, this thing is bad, this thing is wrong, I would listen because I trust you. You're from my community. But whereas if a police officer who doesn't live in my community comes in, they have no right to tell me anything. We need to fund our elders. We need to fund our communities, and not the white men who live in Parma and Webster coming in with guns.
I concur with that.
Kerry Coleman, where do you agree and disagree with the case that Stanley is making?
I agree with Brother Stewart and Brother Stanley. I just want to put my story. I have never had anybody in my family die from gun violence. I can relate to that. But I can relate to an issue with mental health where I call for help. And like Stanley and Amon said, I had an officer come to my house with a gun. And this officer came to my home with a gun. He savagely, after they came in my house, just busted my house, they savagely beat my family member was under distress, mental health, put a gun to the back of my head. Right? Is this how we do this in our community? If this happened in Fairport, this would have made every news station, every across upstate New York. See the difference? There's a disconnect, and we have a lack of resources in our communities to address these issues. There's another veteran. I'm a veteran. He was chased to death on Tremont Street. This shows the lack of resources we need to address. When you send a blunt hammer for an issue where you only need a brush, you're going to have different issues like this. And I think this is not being addressed. You know, our black families have suffered trauma a lot, right? We need to look at that. We need to look at these resources and reallocate these resources to counter that. You can't only put so much police in a community without some kickback. You can only do so much with law enforcement without addressing a trauma issue. And I feel this needs to be addressed.
All right. I got to give the last 30 seconds to Iman. Go ahead, Iman.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's really important to recognize is that for a lot of people, they think, okay, there are people out here saying defund the police and abolish the police, but have you tried to reform the police? And what I say is, yes, people have tried to do that and it hasn't worked. We've tried to increase spending on body-worn cameras, as Stanley said, has not worked. People don't turn them on because we still have a culture that believes that these police officers should be protected more than the civilian themselves. And so I think in the place right now, we need to reimagine what public safety looks like. And I do fall in line with what Stanley says, because the institution itself that's existed for hundreds of years has already failed black and brown people and was designed to only curtail what black and brown liberation would look like. And so here we are again. I think the policing is the epitome of white supremacy. And I think we really need to sit with that and think about what it looks like to radicalize the institution and completely eliminate it.
Well, I mean, if there are more specific proposals coming, let's continue the conversation and we'll look forward to that with Iman, Abed Stanley Martin, Reverend Lewis Stewart, Carrie Coleman. I know these are complex issues. A lot of agreement on the panel and some disagreement, and thanks for making the time for the program, and let's all talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you, everyone on the panel.
You got it. Thank you. Short break, more connections next. We'll